My name is Sharon Anderson. I work in a leadership center at the University of Minnesota, but I'm not a theorist on leadership and I don't have any answers. But when our little center was started, actually, when Hubert Humphrey got sick with cancer, and he hosted a luncheon in Washington, D.C., and a lot of his good friends in Washington wanted to build a monument in Washington to his life, not as a politician, but as... I think it's to report. You can't hear me. Are you having trouble hearing?
No, well, I heard you a little bit, but it seems that it doesn't come through the mic.
Okay, I think this is to record for the tape. I think they tape the sessions.
I'll hear it for her.
No, I'll try to...
I have a hearing enhancement. Would you like a hearing enhancement?
Yeah, maybe that will help. Okay. So what happened then was some people felt that they wanted to celebrate his gifts to try to enhance public life. And so he started thinking about that and said, you know, what I've missed as a public servant, as a servant to sort of trying to enhance public life, was a place where people like ourselves could go and really talk about the issues and their different views on the issues. So that's really how the Leadership Center that I worked in got started, was not to sort of do training, but more of a dialogue and to talk about issues, to talk about the substance of issues, to bring people together that have very different views and very different approaches. So does that give you a little flavor of kind of the setting that I work in? So the kinds of work then that our center does, sometimes we do a lot of group work with communities. So right now we're working with the city of Minneapolis and both neighborhoods in the city, but also elected officials and neighborhood councils and people who work for the city. And we're working together to try to figure out how to align all of our different agendas, so that our city is more focused. Like, think of the city or the communities that you're a part of. How do you build a community focus? And then how do you get citizens all committed to bringing that focus to life, as opposed to being somebody else's job? And I'm a believer that most agendas today are so difficult that one person can't bring it all to life. That leadership then has something to do with responsibility. And shared responsibility. And I think that that's not something we can teach, but we each need to learn about that and discuss it. And then among ourselves decide who's going to be responsible for what part of the agenda. So in that work then, we took about the first 2 years of the work in our center trying to figure out what's leadership. And then what we would assume some responsibility for. And rather than doing one thing, we started working on trying to develop some frameworks to help people like ourselves understand the nature of leadership. For example, in the United States, leadership is the most commonly used word in a book title today. So then when you go to the bookstore, there are hundreds of books on leadership. How do you choose the one that works for you, that would give you some new insights on your work? So those are the kinds of things that we do, is to try to say, well, what in the literature is coming out, how to choose things. Having said that, then, there's some themes, I think, that percolate to the surface about the nature of leadership itself. And one theme is there's a lot of agreement that you don't lead. You can manage a lot of things, and we all have to do a lot of things, but we lead and persist around things that we care deeply about. So that leadership has something to do with values and meaning. That's how we commit to things. That's when each of us have had this sense that you're sort of on a roll and you feel centered. And it may not be easy, and it's hard work, but you have this sense that it's right for you. At other times, have all of you been in places, and at times when you're sort of doing something and you're asking yourself, why am I doing this? Or you're very frustrated? Well, maybe that has something to do with kind of not being centered. And not around somebody else's work, but around your work and the work that's important for you. So what I thought we could do this morning might have a discussion then, if leadership has something to do with each of us together doing what's important. So it's not, I would argue that it's not only individually doing what's important, but also in a community. Communities work hard together and work best when there's some agreement together that we're doing work that's important. And that we, and communities also have to spend time making sure that everybody feels that the agenda then that's set, is there something in that agenda that's important for everybody. So, now it wasn't long ago when I was invited into a large healthcare organization, and a lot of nurses were leaving. And nurses, it's a field that people don't stay in very long. And what we started finding out is that nurses get into the field of nursing because they want to care for people. But when they get into it, they find that sometimes they're asked to sort of make money and they can't spend their time. So you see they're off-center. That what they're there for is to be there for people in a caring way. But some feel like the field, the way it's evolved, doesn't allow them to do their best work. So we need to kind of do both. This project that involved trying to redesign the organization so that nurses can be more focused with the patients and the people they're there to serve, rather than feeling like they're distracted from the sort of management of the organization, and trying to kind of rethink that. Have any of you worked with somebody that was in sort of a leadership position that you felt didn't believe in the work that was to be done? That wasn't for real about that? So again, I'd argue that leadership has something to do not with the position, but making sure that people who are giving voice to projects believe it in their soul. That what we find is that community work is much more effective when pieces of the agenda are done by the people who care most about those pieces. And so, you know, you can be good at public speaking, but if somebody speaks and you know it's not part of their spirit, their own personal spirit, there's this kind of disjoint. And so I think part of then leadership is kind of helping us all get our own souls aligned with the work that we do in the world and feeling so that it's that centeredness. So leadership work has to be meaningful. I think it needs then for each of us, we have to work within ourselves to figure out our own basic beliefs and values, and then to show that authentically we're sort of doing what we say we believe in. So, for example, because I've been in the sort of paid labor force and I've always been an active volunteer in my community, and I care a whole lot about my son, some of my own personal leadership work has sort of been aligning that so that I spend good time with my family because I need my family very much. But I can sometimes get off center by getting too busy on other things, and then I feel very kind of fragmented. But that's that sort of, like I can say I care much about my son or my mother-in-law, but at times when I'm not there with my family, my behavior and my belief set is sort of disjointed. Or we say in the United States that we care a lot about children and that children are a valuable asset to us. But I think some way our collective behavior as a nation is disjointed from that. Our children are one of the poorest groups in this country. We aren't there for our children. We're busy on other things that somehow careers and other things sort of take precedent over caring for our children collectively. So I would argue that that's a leadership disjoint about sort of the stated mission, which is to care for our children, and our real mission need to be looked at. And we need to look at that together to figure out what do we want to do about that. So I think leadership then has something to do with finding a way to align us with our deepest sense of ourself. And that it involves both our head and our heart. So when morale is struggling in our organizations, that I think it's serious, but it's not the sort of thing that we can be played with. that involves kind of our spiritual being. And that I think when we start losing our sense and of being hopeful, that we can make things work better. I mean, in a school, you work in a school. I think school spirit's an important thing, but it's much more than the paint on the walls. I mean, it's about our collective spirit and our hope that we can get our work done.
That it unites something to do with care and hope. And that it has to do, it allows people to show up at the table and bring their gifts. Not to be wait for permission to give their gifts, but that we share responsibility of sort of together giving our gifts. So I thought this morning what I'd like to do is together talk about some times when situations where you felt sort of disjointed, and maybe we can get some ideas on how to, you know, either think back when you felt like you're disjointed or distracted, and how you sort of got back on target, or even a situation where you feel you're disjointed and are sort of wrestling with that, what to do about that, or a group that you're a part of feels disjointed, kind of fragmented. So it doesn't even have to be a personal story. It could be a story where a group that you're a part of is feeling like it's not very centered. I'll give you an example of a group I was working with. They happened to be superintendents of schools in the metropolitan area of Minneapolis. And they felt disjointed because the legislature makes all sorts of laws about how we run our public schools. And they felt like they were always whining and arguing about these new laws that we kept generating that weren't really the best laws for kids. And so they were saying, we're not leaders, we're sort of just whiny reactors. And so they felt they were being asked to sort of do a lot of sort of management work that sort of lost track of why they got into education to begin with, but trying to create and be proactive about creating educational systems that really support and nurture our children. So, does that make sense, where they felt like what they were doing day to day and putting out fires and doing a lot of other things was taking them away from kind of their own personal center? And so together they decided to be proactive and worked and created some new legislation in the state of Minnesota to deal with segregation and some of the issues of race that play themselves out in our school system, got some money set aside, and started working together on a project that really brought to life some of the things that were percolating in the backs of their minds that they didn't know how to do, but they thought together they might have some success, which they did. So what about some of you?
One of the things that I'm a school teacher, One of the frustrations that I've experienced, and I think many of my colleagues have experienced, is there is a vision that each of us have. I think we went in with that desire to make a difference. You know, just in your description of the context of nursing, and being in the system for a while, what seems to happen to the institution. Is that there's kind of a loss of personal empowerment. There's a sense of, do I really make a difference? And so much of what seems to happen is that there are institutionalized ways of instructing, and it's almost assumed, it seems to me, that at times the administration, the states, and the various levels of authority, responsibility, pretty well dictate what it is that, mm-hmm. that you teach and how you teach, and there are many parameters, pretty clearly defined parameters that define what you do in that job, mm-hmm. and hence, of course, there's a loss of creativity and a loss of personal empowerment, I think, and it's frustrating.
So you feel that, an educator, yeah. of thinking back about your own personal hopes of what you might do, but then the context, the organizational context, becomes a real barrier to kind of that kind of spiritual alignment.
I think he's described something that's been one of the biggest frustrations of my life. I started out thinking I had all kinds of leadership gifts. Mm-hmm. I think it was because I got into public speaking, therefore I was elected president of everything in high school and college. Mm-hmm. And then my first abrupt difficulty was discovering no in the Methodist church, being a Methodist pastor. No, you have a district superintendent, and you have rules, and you have this Methodist discipline, and you have all these things. And so I felt like half of me at least is cut off, is shut down. So after 50 years in the ministry, I don't think I ever used the same kind of leadership gifts that I had that led me into the ministry. Mm-hmm. And then I really saw this thing in the worst possible thing when I was a department head at Western State Hospital. And I saw our department is in competition with this department. Labor is in competition with management. The state hospital is always fighting Olympia. The morale of the whole thing was always low. And there seemed to be so little freedom to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And it's a little like you're saying with the structure of the schools. Mm-hmm. And I say that many businesses are run the same way. I think of my children and their problems. And this is just one of the biggest frustrations of my life. I don't know what to say about it.
I'm also an educator. I teach English at a high school. And my biggest frustration has been the change in the students. Has really stifled my ability to be a teacher and to lead and to try new things because I spend a majority of my time trying to discipline in many cases. And when that your energy has to go to that, then the time's up and the creativity and the lesson plan and the wonderful sharing and those types of things that we were able to do at one time have gone. And also the changes. We went to a trimester to ninth grade coming up, and now they're talking, that was 2 years ago, now they're talking about block scheduling. Mm-hmm. So you're just constantly, I don't know what you're in, but you're really off-centered from what you wanted to be. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a teaching background also, and I was a principal for 1 year, and I had a horrendous experience. Partly because we're from California and the cutbacks in education have been so severe there. So when I started, I was first of all young. That's somewhat of a disadvantage, I think. Being a woman sometimes would be a disadvantage, I don't know. Parents were so angry. I was in kind of a high-powered, well-educated community, which I actually hadn't taught in, so I wasn't used to working with that community. I had worked in more of a community where the parents weren't educated and, anything the teachers said was okay. But moving into becoming a principal in a community where parents had their opinions very strong. And it was a very difficult experience. One, because I got criticized a lot. I wasn't used to being in the limelight in that sense. As here in the classroom, you can make lots of mistakes, and kids kind of criticize you, or they don't really care, or you mess up a little bit on lesson, and it's really no big deal. You don't have to do perfect because you're not on stage all the time. But what I didn't realize was that you know everybody's looking at you when you're a principal or in a position of authority like that. So being in the limelight was difficult. Parents were extremely angry, very angry at what was going on. And so my first interaction with them was 200 of them kind of yelling at me or the superintendent or the authority figures because the busing schedule changed. So there was a lot of anger. And teachers were extremely angry also because there had been cutbacks in pay schedule, a lot of programs cut. So a lot of animosity, and so people need someone to blame. And if you're new in green, it's a hard place to be. Mm-hmm. But when you talked about having your heart in it, there were programs that parents really wanted that were so important to them, the most vocal parents, that affected a small group of students, and that didn't affect a large group, and didn't affect a lot of the Spanish-speaking students at the school. And so they knew my heart wasn't in it because I had this kind of mouth that stuff would come out quickly. Diplomacy isn't always that easy, you know, when you get angry. But it's no fun to be in a position of authority where everyone's angry. And people are angry and criticizing you all the time. And then you have to enjoy being a problem solver. Because what you get are problems all the time. This is wrong, this is that. And it's, I don't know. Another problem I found in leadership position was, first of all, it's lonely because the teachers are kind of the gang, you know, and you're separate. But there was, because of cutbacks, because of the pressures, you're doing a job that's way beyond the capability of one person. So you work too, you know, you work too hard. And so you can't have balance. One of the things I said is I'm going to be in the shop and I'm going to be balanced because I'm not a type A workaholic personality, but in order to survive in that position, you're forced into being unhealthy physically, you know, emotionally. If you can keep, I mean, it was just all I could do to kind of keep my emotional balance. But you're in this structure that makes it impossible to really kind of be, I think, a healthy human being. I saw some administrators who were very excellent, and they're also very overweight, a couple women. You know, I mean, they weren't able to take care of themselves. And so their family was neglected. So, you know, it's, who wants to be in a position of leadership when everybody's angry? You get blamed for a lot of things. It's very difficult to make mistakes. And you have to work yourself like a dog. I mean, I don't know where the spiritual benefits intrinsic value. When I saw our superintendent, you know, I don't know how much integrity was there. I mean, that's, you want to be a person of integrity and you expect other people to operate in that way. There isn't a set of values that are determined in that. Like in a 12-step program, there is a really structured, equal value system that everybody's working against. So people are working with, I should say, so there's an equality there that's defined in the steps and the traditions of a 12-step program. You don't necessarily have that. Everybody isn't in agreement. So backstabbing, you know, gossiping, all that stuff can go on. There isn't a sense of, are we working in community together? There's a sense of you better not screw up. Mm-hmm. So that's my complaint.
Does that sound common to some of the situations that some of you are in or a part of or working in?
5 years ago, I came to Holden as part of my sabbatical because I really burned out in the parish because of the kind of dissonance you're talking about. My vision of what we needed to do and be was so different. I felt we were in a cultural captivity in the church, and that I lost hope in being able to break out of that. I couldn't see how, because people were so bound by tradition, and they didn't even know it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the way we do things, that I became very angry at the church for being what it was. And I couldn't function well anymore. And, you know, we grew a large church while I was there, and it didn't satisfy. And now being out of it 3.5 years, I can see the perspective. I watch the pastors struggle, and those that have an integrity are burning out, because they can't survive in a system that's so bound up. And you can't remain authentic. And if we're really there to reach a lost, which I don't believe the church believes, really, because it doesn't act that
way.
The lost. Oh. If we're really there to serve people and reach people who don't know Christ, I see leaders burning out because they have that vision. But we're really there as congregations to serve ourselves. I mean, ultimately, most of our churches are there to serve. A study was done of Lutheran congregations in 1993, church membership initiative, 80% of congregations are primarily focused on serving the current membership, 80%. Only 20%, this is nationwide, have a focus beyond themselves. That says something, I think. So if you got leaders who want to focus beyond, I mean, it's almost an impossible task. Mm-hmm. And so finally you give up and you say, So the question is, how can we renew renew within us? And that's one system. Education is another, you know. And you look at these serving institutions in our society, I think they all have something in common there. We all are struggling with the same thing. How can we break out of and remain authentic to ourselves and deal with the dissonance that's there between what we feel, our values, and what we see in the institution? Medical field. I mean, my wife is a nurse and left for the same reason that you were talking about. I mean, just how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. And I think it also has, I would argue, it has something to do with us each giving our gifts. And whether or not we consider ourselves as individuals, a leader or a follower, or, you know, but I think most of us do best in giving and sharing our gifts when we're centered and see an avenue to make the contribution that is meaningful to us. So I would consider that to be the rigor of personal leadership, is finding ways to align what we might have to contribute. So it's not just about positional leaders in our institutions. I think it's the fabric of all of us who are part of any institution of redesigning so that we've got all these gifts and that aren't being contributed. So I think it's important and frustrating.
I'm talking too much. I believe I accomplished more because I felt free to use whatever gifts I have. Mm-hmm. In 1 year, my senior year in college, than any year since, that was 1940 or 41. Mm-hmm. That was the big year of using my gifts. And right now, I have a much smaller problem, but a greater opportunity. The opportunity is, as a retired minister, I'm looking for a niche. I'm joining a different church and trying to say, well, what is the role of a retired pastor? And oh, what a confusion if you go to different pastors and ask them that question. And one says, I'm burnt out, I'm not interested. Another one says, your job is to stay out of the way. Anyway, I could go on and on. But on the other hand, the church has these beautiful dreams, and it has a world of retired pastors, many of whom their last years would be fulfilled much more if they had opportunities to feel needed. And they got all this experience, and nobody wants it, you know. I've talked to this.
And that's not only. I've had a chance. We invented a new organization along the same lines. So a few of us started thinking of people who are involved. I'm real interested in the nature of volunteerism because that's my life's work. Even though I'm in a job where I get paid, a lot of my life's work is community work, and I've learned a lot through my community work. That's really where I've gone to school. And a bunch of us started thinking about this very thing, about a lot of people in this country, and particularly in other countries, have never learned how to volunteer. I mean, and I'm working with people from former countries that were part of the former Soviet Union. They've never had community-based organizations. I mean, they don't have that infrastructure. I mean, they haven't had the church for many years. I mean, it's just different. And so we started thinking about, and in the United States, most people, actually, you're
probably an exceptional set because people were connected with churches and nonprofit organizations are. But a lot of people who work in the private sector have not had time or have not done very much volunteer work. And we started thinking about people at the time of retirement. People have all these capacities and all these gifts, but how can we get then people who work in companies, for-profit companies, to take those gifts and those skills and transfer them to community work? Okay, so that we, even though they won't be employed by a company. So we created something called the National Retiree Center. It's a national organization, and we work with major corporations around the United States and convince companies to set up retiree offices where then those are centers where people, when they retire, are it interfaces with community groups and community work that where they might take their skills and make those contributions in the broader community. And they design it themselves. For example, in Pittsburgh right now, we have a big project going on that the corporations in Pittsburgh area have, all the retirees from those corporations, about 8 corporations, have taken on responsibility to design a literacy program for the state in a variety of ways. But if you've been working, if you've been a bookkeeper, then those people are helping keep the books, that same sort of thing about how do we continue to share. And it gets back to this notion is that sometimes our organizations with good intentions, the structures, limit us rather than help us. And that they're also very intimidating. They can be because they have their own culture. And they sort of have these unstated rules about the roles we have to play as individuals. And sometimes those can be really scary. Also, this notion of sort of, well, it's not just mine, but then special interest groups play a role. And so we have all these mixed agendas. John Gardner, who some of you may know, he started Common Cause, and he helped us when we started our center. And he had a way of kind of talking about that. I'll share that with you. And that is that the challenge is sort of like if this is the floor of the ocean and these are the white caps, okay, he would say, John thinks that part of leadership then, if the floor of the ocean are personal values, okay, so each of us has sort of the things that are important to us as individuals, and that needs to be the floor of the ocean. And then he would say that we've got these white caps. And he would say that those are special interest groups, the things that you saw in your school. You know, and so some special groups come in and they lobby their point, and so we've got these white caps. Not bad or good, but it's just part of the ocean. And what John thinks is that we've got to do then much better in the calm, in the center, of finding ways to create some common ground. But a lot of organizations spend a lot of time how to deal with the storms of the day and crisis management. So I'm always thinking about sort of this center of how we can reinvent our organizations so that it has a common ground that's more user-friendly. And so it creates an environment where we really think we can do a better job of sort of contributing. Now you mentioned personal empowerment. And I think there's a lot of good resources, but difficult. And one of the things that I've learned from a couple Lutherans, actually, they're psychologists at St. Olaf. They've done a lot of work. They started working with kids in chemical dependency, and they had some big projects. But they've done a lot of work that's been helpful to me on empowerment, and not only personal empowerment, but also how we can be better catalysts to empower others around us. But there's some themes that came out of their work that I thought was really helpful. 4 themes in places where organizations have been able to sort of find this common ground that's more empowering, that uses our gifts. And the 4 things are, 1 is that you have to know people by name. Now think about that and how difficult it is to know people by name. I just agreed to work on a big project in a big county that Minneapolis is in, and with their human services division. It's Hennepin County, and it happens to be the county that City of Minneapolis sits in. But they're trying to redesign their organization in human services. And so now I think about, well, how might we develop a redesign here as a team? To kind of say, now how would you set up a whole county system so that everybody knew each other by name? Not by numbers, you know, in our schools, when you get big schools. You know, we have a lot of people. Do we know each other by name? And if we can't, then maybe we have to break it down. Second thing, so it's that eye to eye, and that we need to find ways to be there for each other. Second thing is that you personally have to care. Which is this piece, that we can't empower others if we personally aren't committed around things. That means we have to be able to delegate. The third thing, which makes a lot of sense, is that in order to build an empowering system, there has to be a give and a take. It's the thing that concerns me in positional leadership about being on the receiving end and waiting for permission rather than kind of shared responsibility and a give and a take. So what are the schools going to do for me? Is the sort of mental image that it's a one-way thing rather than a give and a take. And yet what we know about children and teaching is that parents, when parents and families and communities are more involved with the children do better. When it's designed, when the infrastructure of the organization is designed as a give and a take. So in our churches, you know, there. I think we have to. The organizational design has to be designed to go two ways. That's the concern of, you know, too much focus one way internally violates what we understand about empowerment. But the last one, the fourth theme on empowerment, is the one where we make the most mistakes, and that is that empowering systems and to empower others. Is not about asking people what can I do for you if you want to empower somebody. How do you feel when somebody says to you, what can I do for you? Do you feel like you're inadequate in some way? You're sort of needy? That's what most people feel. That if we want to effectively empower others, we have to ask them for help. Which is not give an answer or to say, what can I do, or to provide a service. So, for example, in schools, how do we ask our, if we were trying to empower kids, how do we ask them for help? See, if we're trying, and so how do we then redesign the infrastructure of our organizations to bring those themes to life? So, for example, in the church, how does the church regularly ask for help? When so often, those of us who feel like we want somebody to help us, who we're sort of consumers of, has to be the other way. So in some of the redesign, I think it's kind of addressing those kinds of questions. See, so as an educator, how good it feels when somebody comes into your classroom and says, you know, I really need your help on this. Or we go to kids and ask for that, or we go to church groups. And say, you know, we don't, rather than having answers, it's raising the questions. So, which is always, things are never as they appear. You know, it's that notion that I think, or asking a friend, you know, I mean, when I get a lot of help when I feel like I'm off center, when I remember and have enough courage to go to somebody and say, you know, I'm really feeling out of sorts. You know, can you help me think through how I might sort of get back in alignment? Or I'm feeling really frazzled. So I think we can do also some things to kind of help ourselves get recentered if we sort of remember that. But I think, you know, the point that was made of sort of this need to be perfect violates what we understand and know about leadership itself. And that is one of our greatest resources in leadership is making mistakes. if we have the courage to keep track of our mistakes and examine them so we don't replicate them. So that rather than seeing mistakes as sort of a deficit and a bad thing, they teach us a great deal. If we remember that that's a resource for us.
Profit from your mistakes.
Mm-hmm. But we say that, but profit, it's hard to do. And you know,
profit from your mistakes in the sense that you learn.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why I think it's important in leadership work for all of us to have times when we think, when have I felt off center? And then what did you do or what did I do to kind of get myself back in alignment? We can learn from each other on that. It's a way that we can teach each other because we might get some fresh ideas.
Sharon, mm-hmm. You know, I go to Hennepin Methodist Church in Minneapolis, which is a big downtown church. We use our retired ministers to teach classes, pay them to maybe take 3 months at a time to visit people because our main pastor doesn't have the time if they're good at visiting. And we use them that way. Mm-hmm. And they all come in and I think they love it because they feel that they are needed.
And I think it's a thing where we so often in our organizational work feel that we don't have enough money. Are a lot of you in organizations where fundraising is a big issue or we feel like, well, we can't do that until we raise the money? Mm-hmm. See, my sense is that money is one thing, but I think oftentimes we don't do a very good job of looking at all the people capacities and resources that we have that are lying dormant. So that I think that's another asset that we often have that we don't take full advantage of. But I think also it's nice to be in environments where people are asked to contribute. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. You know, I was involved with a rural county where it was in the western region of Ohio, and their economy was bedraggled. And they were trying to figure out a way together that throughout the county, organizations and churches and schools could work together to sort of get through this hard time. So it was a community-wide challenge. And they would have community meetings and nobody would come. And so we started saying, well, you know, doing more of the same thing probably won't help, like sending out flyers, you know, because people were discouraged. What we learned together in that is when they started thinking about what got them to show up, it was when somebody asked them. So they started, in terms of the strategy then, to kind of do this work. Rather than doing a flyer posting things, people took personal responsibility to call a friend and say, I want you to come with me to this meeting. And so it was sort of learning. It wasn't anything fancy. It was just that experience where they looked at their own experience and thought about what got them to reinvest in community life. It was just having somebody make a call and say, I'd like to have you there. And I mean, that's that thing of knowing people by name, of somebody calling you by name and inviting you in. And yet, so many times, I think our organizations get too fancy. You know, and it's part of the culture we're a part of, where we sort of, this mass sort of TV and everything has to be flashy and we never quite feel like we're sort of adequate or glitzy enough. But I think it's in some ways for some of it anesthetizes us. I mean, it just puts us under. It's kind of numbing. And I think to rekindle our inner spirits, you know, I think there's magic about being there for each other.
Mm-hmm. I think you have a lot of teachers here. Yeah, I'm also a high school teacher. And I just finished the best year of teaching that I've ever had. And I took a risk last year. And I try to let go of my vision of what a leader should be, which I think a lot of people think of leadership as of being in a position of power and control. And I instead try to talk to each student more on a one-to-one and with more respect and making that mm-hmm. initial contact, not being concerned and letting go, which I think is hard for teachers, of what who I was as a teacher, of it not being teacher-centered, and who I was I doing a good job, and all those worries that come into it, and having some sort of an outcome, and what were the grades, and how were they all doing, and all of that later. And instead, I tried to make the whole experience student-centered. And I allowed myself to be kind of a buffoon sometimes and make big mistakes that the kids seem to appreciate. I think they learned from seeing that in me as much as they did from any lesson that I gave. And it was by far the best year I've ever had. And
for you personally?
For the students.
Okay.
The students.
What about for you?
It was for me also.
Okay.
It was for me also. And by being able to let go of what our notion of what a leader is, it made all the difference in the world to me. And that was difficult to do. It was difficult to not be thinking of how was I going to be rated by my superintendent at the end, by my supervisor at the end of the year on my evaluation, which is what every teacher goes through. And I took those risks. And it paid off. And I'm going to do it again next year. But I think some of that comes with age. You know, I'm old enough now that I thought, I don't care. I don't care what that evaluation's like, you know. And that was, and that's hard to say. That's very hard to say. But I think that there is a time when that wisdom comes in, when you're not so, you know, I think we all have this idea of what a leader is. And I really hate the word, just like you say, it's on every book you pick up now. And everybody's got a new policy and a new procedure and a new way and a new reform. And we're all reforming and all of this is supposed to change our lives. But the more meetings that I went to, the more frustrated I became. And I stopped going to them. And it was great. I really tried to get back in touch and to let go of what, you know, of that, of how I was always worried about other people were looking at my teaching skills. I let go of it. And I'd say it's the first year in 10 years that I received thank you notes from students at the end of the year. I mean, that rarely happens for teachers. And the things that they picked out were some little inconsequential meeting that maybe we had, or one day when I had lunch with them, something like that that you never think of. And it was wonderful. It was an absolute renewal to, instead of thinking in such a broad concept of that I was going to change this, you know, 180 kids a year, that I would instead
start with yourself and your own classroom,
and and asking their opinions and for their help more, allowing them to be themselves more, letting go.
So how you organized your classroom changed as well.
Yes, I got rid of a lot of the organization.
That was a huge
boost.
It's right scary there. Though. You know, and I mean, I think the other thing in that is that sometimes people do that and you get fired. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it's not without risk. Mm-hmm. And it's very serious. I mean, some of the people that I work with actually get killed.
Mm-hmm. Get killed?
They're from other parts of the world.
Yes.
And they're, as a matter of fact, I just spent the last 2 months with one of my colleagues, trying to help him get political asylum, because it was real clear to him and to those of us who were working with him that if he were to go back to Sudan currently, he would get put in prison for his views and of sort of a different approach.
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot of responsibility. I mean, helping our kids do the right thing sometimes, you know, is very serious because of the situations that they're in.
What I then ended up feeling was being viewed as antisocial, which I've never thought of myself being antisocial. But because I did not want to participate in all of the meetings and all of this, I mean, I found it to be a waste of time, which or a waste of energy that could be placed much better, and would work much better. So you do take a risk of being an outcast that way.
I think, you know, in all of the examples that were mentioned, there are kind of some themes that are present. This frustration with organizational design. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's interesting because I think
I work in a school of public affairs, so we're looking at what I call the messes, which is the issues that go beyond an organization that you can't contain and address. For example, the messes of children in education go beyond the walls of any organization, whether it be a family or the church or the schools, but that there are a lot of sort of community issues that are not contained within an organization. I think it's one of the frustrations of, for example, the church, is that the church, the walls of the church can't contain the issues that it's trying to partner with. And so it's about a mess. And so when we get too structured in our organization, it's disjointed. So we do a lot of work looking at sort of rethinking and trying to figure out ways we can kind of so that most organizations are built like they have a hierarchical structure in order to be more efficient. And there are good reasons for that. I'm not putting that down. But what I call a mess is as if this is the region, within your region, you've got all sorts of other organizations that are working, right? Churches and schools and a variety of other things. And you've got people. So you've got groups of people, and you also have sort of informal organizations. So special interest groups, right? And so then when you start thinking about education and learning as a community good, because a lot of you are in education, the issue is so complex, or healthcare is another one, right? Mm-hmm. That how can you manage, and we lead sort of healthcare, when most of the ways that we've been taught to design, to organize something are based on this model, but this is the reality of the community. So we can't be too hard on ourselves. That's one theme, I think, in alignment, is that when we feel contained in this model and forget that it's really like this, and to sort of, I just bought a card over in the bookstore on patience, you know, like, hurry up. But I think that, so we got to be kind to ourselves and remember there's a difference in that we can't allow sort of the constraints of the organization that we're in to dampen our spirit, to try to have some courage to kind of redesign.
Mm-hmm. But one answer to knowing the capacity of the group that you mentioned. I was at a church of 5,300 members on the staff and was delighted that they had one full-time staff member who did nothing but go from home to home and interview the adults particularly. And instead of handing them a questionnaire to fill out, she filled out the questionnaire, asking them all about their background, their experiences, their honors, their interests, their hobbies, their gifts, and everything, so that the church then had a file, mm-hmm, of what people like to do, what they enjoyed, what they are capable of, and mm-hmm, and then could place people in strategic positions. And I've always wished I could do the same thing in my local, mm-hmm, church.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's also a nice way to ask people for help. You know, if they're on a card, it's a lot easier to say, you know, when if your circle's trying to get something done, to say, well, who in our congregation can help us, and call them up. You know, that's a good example.
And now we've got computers,
example.
So we ought to be able to just,
right,
say,
I mean,
here are six,
you know,
people,
I mean,
that could do
so
this.
So I think little ways, even, that we can begin to change. I mean, a good way to change organizations also is to look at other sort of samples. So, for example, your classroom. See, how did you redesign your classroom so that it worked better for you? And that becomes a way to rethink how, you know, to try some new things out. Unfortunately, a lot of organizations are very bureaucratic. And so we have these rigid policies, and everybody has to do it the same way. And that can be limiting, too. So that's a real challenge. You were going to say something? Did you? Okay. The other thing I think that came up a lot in the discussion this morning that I heard is this, it is about fear, and personal fear and organizational fear. And I've been reading a lot on kind of the shadow and fear, and I think that one of the things that I think, oftentimes when people talk about leadership, they often also talk about courage. And there's some people that see getting better, being more courageous in our leadership as individuals, as organizations, has to do with embracing what we're afraid of. So oftentimes fears are about being isolated, but having ways together to work those through. So I'm often in places where, as a team member, I get to ask the questions, what are people afraid of? What are we afraid of in this organization? And actually that's helpful to get out on the table and to really examine that so we can get beyond it. Because if we don't, it becomes an invisible barrier. And courage often is just getting it out on the table so we can move beyond it. So what are kids afraid of? What are teachers afraid of? What are members of congregations afraid of? And oftentimes, you know, things like, I'm afraid I'm going to make a mistake and look like an idiot. Well, then 6 or 7 other people have been feeling the same way. And that we don't need a workshop on innovation. We just need to be more patient with each other when we try things and they don't work out. Do you see? So I think that came up also in terms of alignment is sometimes we get out of alignment and doing what's important because of that sort of in that kind of shadowy thing about what we're afraid of. Both, and I would argue too, I think not just individually but also together in our organizations. So thank you for coming this morning. It's a good discussion.
Thank you.
We can help each other too. That's the nice thing, is that, you know, together we really can do things that we can't kind of work through as individuals. So I bet you found that out too in your work when you... But it is kind of nice. It's freeing when you kind of feel like you're back on a roll. Mm-hmm.